Support for Aspen Public Radio comes from Balcom & Green PC, a full-service law firm with offices in Glenwood Springs, Aspen, and Basalt, providing advice and solutions for their clients' legal needs throughout Western Colorado for more than 60 years. Learn more at balcomgreen.com.
Live from Aspen Public Radio, I'm Allison Bechtesh. This is Valley Roundup. This week, how will the Valley address the short-term rental market and the marijuana market? It's Justice Snow's last stand in the Wheeler Opera House, and the Aspen Art Museum tries to include more of the community. Also, how students and schools in the Roaring Fork Valley are reacting to the national discussion about gun control and safety. All that and more coming up on Valley Roundup. Joining me today to put all of this in context and give their insights are Curtis Wackerly, the editor for the Aspen Daily News. Hi, Curtis.
Good afternoon.
And Jason Auslander, reporter with the Aspen Times. Hi, Jason. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, Allison.
And Samuel Bernal, station manager of Radio La Tricolor. Thank you all for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Thanks for having us.
All right, let's start out with some sad news that we got this over the weekend of an accident on Highway 82. And Jason, you've been following both kind of the breaking news on that and some of the follow-up incidents and things that we're going to start asking ourselves about that intersection. Can you just start by establishing that story, what happened?
Yeah, this was a Sunday morning. A guy driving a SUV came up to a stop sign. It's unclear whether he stopped or not. And apparently kind of went out right in front of a speeding raft bus, and he died. His 5-year-old son was in the back seat in some sort of a car seat, whether it was more like, I think it was more like one of those booster seats, which one person told me probably saved his life. And then there was a 29-year-old nanny also in the front seat who was pretty seriously injured as well.
Curtis, you had people on the scene as well, that you had a front cover photo of perhaps the son in this incident.
Right. Our photographer just happened to be driving by right after it happened and got some pretty powerful photos. You know, there were first responders on the scene, and one of the images is of one of them hugging and comforting the boy.
And we do know that is the son in the situation?
That's our understanding.
Okay.
I talked to somebody who was there, too, who described exactly that picture, too. So I imagine that's probably him, although many people said they had heard that the kid had 2 broken femurs. So wondered how that could possibly be happening. But, you know, he could have been he's probably in shock. And, you know,
right.
So I think it was probably him.
An astounding photo to get, especially if that was just a happenstance, you know, but one that I think really will stay in the minds of the people who drive past that intersection every single day. So of course, both the county and the state, because that is a state highway, are now discussing that intersection. It's had multiple deaths over decades, including one year where there was 6 people. I mean, that's what Capitol Peak was this year, and we're talking about how to make that safer. I mean, what's been done, and why is that so dangerous? And Jason, I'll start with you.
I don't know about 6. I think 4 were killed in 99.
Okay.
I think then that was the last fatal there. Pretty much anybody who lives in Woody Creek, I think, will tell you that intersection is pretty dangerous. The public works director wants to make sure that people – it's apparently kind of difficult to see if you don't know that you're approaching a busy highway. That intersection is – you can – if you want to go down Valley, you cross up Valley, you cross the down Valley lanes, go to the connector road, and then take a left onto, and you're going to merge into the fast lane coming up, going up Valley too. So it's definitely got some issues. I'm not sure that certainly they're going to look at it, and they're going to meet in the next week or so to see if anything can be done there. I think, though, also kind of on the other side of it is that there hasn't been a fatal there in 20 years, almost 20 years. And so also they'd like to know what the circumstances of this accident are. You know, Dan Blankenship from RAFTA says that the video from the bus shows the car just coming, the SUV going just right in front of the bus, and perhaps not stopping at the stop sign. So I guess that leads to questions of, you know, maybe was there driver distraction right. involved? Was there something else that was at fault here or not?
That same article, though, didn't the CDOT analysis, they thought that he did stop.
That's Colorado State Patrol.
Oh, okay.
Colorado State Patrol initially said, yes, he came to a full and complete stop, and that's what I initially wrote as my follow. Then the guy kind of walked it back
okay.
after that appeared online.
Oh, that's interesting.
And said, well, we're not really sure. He proceeded, according to a preliminary report that he was reading by the trooper who was on scene. This guy's in Denver.
Okay,
you know,
okay.
So it's kind of part of the problem with right. dealing with Colorado State Patrol is that, you know, you've got a guy in Denver trying to extrapolate details from something that he knows nothing about, an intersection he knows nothing about.
Right.
So he said the verbiage in the report is that he proceeded from there. So basically it's unclear
okay.
to them until and the final report's not done yet. I think they're still waiting for the video from the bus.
Okay. And Curtis, I thought the Daily News did report 6 people in 99 and even a 2011 accident from another local person in Woody Creek. What are you hearing from the people in charge, both the county and the state, as to what could be done at that intersection?
Well, the ultimate question is, do you put a stoplight there? I've actually heard a roundabout thrown around there, which doesn't really make a whole lot of sense.
On a highway.
So, let's be honest here. The speed limit, if you're heading down Valley, you're going past Brush Creek Road, I think it's 55. Mm-hmm. People definitely open it up and are driving at interstate highway speeds there.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime you're having to cross Highway 82, if you're making a left off of one of these side roads, it's very dangerous. You have to be very careful because cars are moving fast. There's a lot of traffic. I think this intersection, it's very busy. There's a lot of traffic coming in and out of Woody Creek. So does it justify having a signal there or something else besides what's going on? We've reported that it's been looked at in
okay.
the past, you know, fairly recently, you know, in the last decade. The question has come up, you know, what do we do here? Do we want a signal? The answer at the time was no, and they elected to go with some of these, measures that weren't as, as interfering as putting a signal there. So we added some lanes to help people merge in and out. But I think you're definitely hearing those questions be asked very loudly again of maybe we need to go to another level of intervention.
And from that point of view, I was talking to the guy from the traffic safety guy from CDOT yesterday who was saying that, you know, it's a long process to be able to put a stoplight
sure.
in anywhere, and it takes possibly years because they've got to study it. They've got to look at traffic data. They've got to look at pedestrian data. They've got to look at any number of things, so they don't certainly take that lightly. And oftentimes it can be a hindrance rather than a help. You know, I mean, people can easily blow that light, as you said, because they're moving pretty fast by the time they see it. So, again, it's kind of an odd little blip in the whole thing, but CDOT has that crash data, but
okay.
they've got this ransomware that their networks are down.
It's
so the guy
couldn't. It's such a fascinating part of the story. You both reported it. Well, can you say what that is? I mean, it's got so many interesting elements to it.
It's apparently something called the SAMSAM
okay.
ransomware, and they want a Bitcoin ransom for this. Apparently, there was a hospital in Ohio, I think, paid $55,000
oh,
recently
my gosh.
For the same
to get access to their data again.
According to a Denver Post article, yeah. So, you know, I think they say they're not paying it. So it's just a kind of like the guy's like, look, that's our first step, and I can't really go anywhere, and because that's going to tell you them how dangerous that intersection is, how many crashes have mm-hmm. been there, and if it's. You know, if it's one crash every, to sound sort of callous, if it's one crash every year, they're not going to put a stoplight
right.
in there. But if it's several, that would maybe lead to the next question of should we put a stoplight there?
Yeah, that's so interesting. So anything that they're trying to research right now, they can't get access to, not just this accident data, but the all of CDOT
exactly.
is being held for ransom right now until they pay, and specifically in Bitcoin. That just caught my, that's
yeah.
so futuristic to me that right. I don't know what they're going to do about that. So we did lose a part-time local, Dan Fagan, during that accident. His child was involved, and also that nanny. And Jason, you've been working to find out if she's okay or what her status is.
Yeah, it's been difficult. We've been working with somebody who's a family spokesman, but they've been pretty close-lipped about the conditions of both the boy and the woman. Kind of generally, I'm hearing that the boy is going to be all right. I think he had, like I said, the broken femurs, I think, and a fractured pelvis is what sort
okay.
of, that's very preliminary.
Yeah.
The woman was injured more seriously, so I don't know We're hoping to find out something in the coming days, if we can. I don't know if Curtis, if you guys have any luck.
And I know our listeners and readers will be looking at that just as a community loss. Let's move on to housing and a story that you wrote this week, Curtis, about some of the stuff that the city is trying to do to chomp down on Airbnb, kind of maybe getting away with doing what they're supposed to, Airbnb and sites like that.
Right. So short-term rentals in the city of Aspen have long been a part of our tourism bed base. The city has a pretty liberal policy when it comes to short-term rentals on Airbnb and the like, those kind of platforms.
Okay.
You can do it as much as you want to your heart's content. You can buy a bunch of apartments. You can short-term rent them till the cows come home. You just have to get your business license and get a permit with the city's zoning office and make sure you're paying your taxes and all this. But despite that, many people still go under the radar. You know, there's only like 62 active permits.
Oh my gosh.
On file with the Community Development Department. Meanwhile, there's at least 400 listings available on Airbnb. So, I mean, clearly a lot of people are thumbing their nose at the compliance process here. And so this has long been percolating in the city. They at least want to get, some people are suggesting that maybe our policy is too liberal, but the first thing you have to do is just kind of figure out what's going on, who's there, how many people are doing this, and they don't really have those answers right now, and they're trying to get them. They're taking an approach. There was a lot of discussion about what the city of San Francisco has done, which was really interesting. I learned about this this week. The city of San Francisco passed a law a while back that said, we will fine you, Airbnb, if you host a transaction where someone rents out their place and it's against the rules. It's an illegal short-term rental. We will fine you if you do that. Airbnb sued the city of San Francisco. There was a legal case, and the city got a ruling in its favor. Airbnb and HomeAway then turned around and settled with the city. And what they will now do is if I want to rent my unit in San Francisco, I have to go and get my permit, get my license from the city, and I go and put it on Airbnb, and they will not list it until they go and check that to make sure I'm actually complying. So the city of Aspen wants something like that here, where these platforms won't post these listings without making sure that it's a legal transaction. So that's what the city wants. It sounds like it's going to be a process to get there. Hopefully it doesn't require years of litigation like it did in San Francisco, which does not allow unlimited short-term rentals, by the way. Their rules are much more strict.
And what is the reason that the city says for checking that? I mean, just because of the taxes, or there is some...
Because of the taxes, I think... if it's totally unregulated, it creates more incentive for people to go in and do this. And the worry is that you're taking housing stock away from long-term locals that, I know there's apartments out there that used to be rented out on a long-term basis to people who live here. And the people who own those apartments have recently said, well, this short-term rental thing is really exploding and, I can make $400 a night. So I'm just going to do that. And
isn't there an affordable housing aspect to it too?
Well, there is, to the extent that you cannot do this if you have an affordable housing place.
But people are doing it.
People are doing it because no one's checking to see if people are in compliance or not.
And so I really set this up wrong, that the city's going after Airbnb, VRBO. What they're hoping to do is go after the people who are renting out their homes, and they're hoping to use basically the third-party platform that the people are renting their homes on as enforcement, as their eyes on the ground.
Right. And, there's that makes sense in a way. Like if these companies, they're thriving now, Airbnb is worth the $1 billion or whatever it is because people like using it. They like using the service. It makes it easy. So shouldn't Airbnb have some responsibility to make sure that the business is being conducted on its site, is complying with local laws and regulations? I think they would say that's what they want.
Do you know, someone from the city is speaking with someone who works for Airbnb, and they're trying to work out if they can pull off this new rule, or who are we negotiating with?
Yeah, that's basically how it works. I mean, it's all very cloaked, these negotiations are not happening in public. Apparently Airbnb has offered to collect the taxes and remit them to the city, which would be a step in the right direction, but it's sort of on their terms, at least as far as the city is seeing it. They don't like this standard agreement that Airbnb has offered. They want the agreement to go a step further so they can actually identify who is running these units to make sure that they're that they're in compliance.
And then there's some other they're going to put money towards a software to help them dig through these sites and find out maybe some of that information.
Right. So apparently you can hire these companies that this is what they do. They specialize in examining these listings and trying to match them up to see who, where these actual properties are, who owns them, whether or not they're in compliance. So they're going to put out a request for proposals and maybe we'll hire one of these people to do some work on their behalf. I also think, if they can get this agreement with Airbnb that will require that they will only list qualified places that are registered, maybe there's not a need for that. So it's still very much in discussion.
You are listening to Valley Roundup live from Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh. Joining me here in the studio to put this week's news in perspective for us today are Curtis Wackerly, the editor of the Aspen Daily News, Jason Auslander, reporter with the Aspen Times, and Samuel Bernal of Radio La Tricolor. Stay with us. Thanks for tuning into Valley Roundup. I'm Allison Bechtesh. Jason, you had another story this week about the Pickens County Commissioners and their decision to kind of give the okay, let it be an administrative task to re-up some pot licenses in the county. First, tell me about that, but really it sounds like quite a big switch from this gang.
Yeah, they reauthorized or reapproved two licenses, one of which they approved last year and another which was going on its third year,
okay.
I believe. The one's in Snowmass, one's in the Carbondale area. And, the thing that caught my eye when I was watching was that they're going to allow them to be administratively approved next year, provided there's no issues or odor complaints or anything.
Right.
They haven't got any. The county officials did site visits the day before on Tuesday this last week, and, they found things. There are a couple little minor things, but mostly it was A-okay, and so I think it's just like the normalization of this business after a while that had some bumpy kind of with the edibles, like in the beginning. Same thing here, and even George Newman, who was a commissioner for Pickens County, has not been exactly supportive of it. Is now, he's voting for it and supportive, I think.
So that you said odor, and that makes me think of the High Valley Farms issue, the pot grow Mid-Valley, and that was a huge issue. I mean, they almost didn't get their license renewed. Tons of neighbors complaining, mm-hmm. and that was 2-3 years ago.
Yeah, and I think that there's a similar, I may be wrong about this, but I think as of the last time that Jordan Lewis came in front of the commission, they basically said you can stop the odor monitoring.
Wow.
That he was paying quite a bit of money for there because I think he's got the problem licked.
Okay.
And there hasn't been anything that's risen to the county commission level that I cover. But if there had, I'm pretty sure that they would have known about
right.
it. So I think that it's kind of the same thing where I think he may be administratively approved or possibly administratively approved next year too. So.
And this is the same group who, maybe it was George Newman, had the comment about Brussels sprouts when it came to edibles, and they're so against having edibles at all around. They think it's very bad for kids, that they look like gummies and candies, and almost didn't approve the jerky pot that's right in the ABC.
I wouldn't say that they're so against it. I think that their main problem was with its availability to kids and its appeal.
Yeah.
To kids, gummy bears and cookies and things that kids are going to, naturally gravitate toward. So I think that once that has been, and that's been addressed by the MED in Denver. So I think that, once that happened and also once the jerky, the guy who owns the High Mountain Taxi, I can't remember his name right now, but once he came back with answers to their questions, they pretty readily approved it, and he hasn't had any issues either that I've heard too. So I think again, it's like the normalization.
That's
of
what
weed.
I think. Let it be known, Friday, March 2nd.
I think when this started, the county was being very cautious in its approach, especially with, you know, some new land uses that were being proposed as far as cultivation operations, and some would say maybe using an excess of caution because they were, you know, there were some applications that came up and pretty well got shot down. But I think it's just a case of, you know, the normalization, and now we have a track record, and maybe the sky hasn't fallen, and they're taking a little more comfortable approach.
And the applications that were shot down were, you know, frankly, kind of shoddy.
Okay.
You know, if you want to do this, you need to have your ducks in a row. You need to hire some consultants. You need to there's lots of very, very detailed regulations you got to follow. And if you do it, this, I think, proves that if you, you know, toe the line, it can be smooth.
Moving on to another government story this week. There is a new lease for the Wheeler Opera House. And it could be as long as 15 years, Curtis?
It could be. It's a 5-year lease with 2 5-year tenant options. So if this tenant works out and is successful, they could be there for 15 years.
The one thing that caught my eye from that article is that during the RFP process, we wanted the company that went in there to be locally serving, and that's kind of like fallen away as to an actual price point of what that is, and be open most of the year and hopefully have breakfast. And I don't understand what the breakfast may be piloted of the next restaurant that's coming in. Are we not getting guaranteed breakfast here?
No guaranteed breakfast.
Okay, they say they're interesting.
They say they're going to give it a shot and see how it works. They really want to do it, but they're not being told they have to.
That's not going to be part of the lease to have breakfast after all that.
Right. This lease has fewer strings on it than Justice Snow's did. You know, Justice Snow's had to submit its menu for like a price comparison where they took the average cost of a plate of chicken, and you had to be within, you know, 2 standard deviations of the mean or else you got your wrist slapped. And I mean, one of the things that's most interesting to me about this whole thing is the new operator, which is the owner of the Capitol Creek Brewery in Willits, their application was smiled upon because they said they will not do any live music or live entertainment.
Wow.
And this was like, this was Kylie's bread and butter at Justice Snow, was doing these music series. And I don't know if everyone just felt like if that was not a positive aspect of the business. A lot of people would argue otherwise, that that's what was great about Justice Snow, is they had all this live music. But that is being left out of this application very purposefully so, and that was one of the reasons why the city liked it.
That is fascinating.
Yeah.
Samuel, we did a story this week. Our reporter Wyatt Orm checked in with Sandra Lopez, who is in Sanctuary in Carbondale right now, checking in on what that daily life is. You know, she hasn't stepped outside in 4 months, so yoga classes come to her and English classes come to her. You have an update about her as well.
Yes, she wrote me this morning to let me know that next Thursday, she would be connected via Skype with 104 women. I think it's the Women's Day on Thursday.
Okay,
yeah.
Great.
So they will use that day, and she will connect with other 4 women. And she said that they will announce a strategy they have to be able to liberate themselves.
Wow.
So I'm very curious about it. It will be next Thursday, 6:30 p.m. at the 3rd Street Center in Carbondale. So
everyone can watch that Skype happen.
I think you have to go there.
Yeah,
yeah, you have to go to the 3rd Street Center, and there's where they will have all these screens, and they will let the people know what will be the next step. And
wow, again, so futuristic. I also want to hear about some of the immigrant storytelling events that Radio La Tricolor has been involved in. What are some of the stories you're hearing? Anything that's stuck with you?
Yes, it's been very interesting because there's like a renaissance of the life storytelling. That's what I've seen. It's happening everywhere. Cool. And it's a lot of organizations that are interested with the immigrant community. They are organizing events that had to do with storytelling, like English in Action.
Okay.
We just had a live storytelling this year. And then also Carbondale Arts District.
Uh-huh.
They're doing also this park in Carbondale, where they want to have a sculpture with immigrant stories.
Wow.
Yeah. And this Sunday in Aspen Art Museum, they will also be collecting stories with Carbondale Art District. And, you know, the museum will have an exposition of portraits, family portraits of immigrants families that were last year at the museum, they had a picture of their family, and that would be very nice.
Why do you think that's important? Like, what have you seen in the Arte en Español events that the Art Museum holds over time where you do want to see yourself or something that looks like you up on the walls of an art museum?
Yeah, generally, they have been doing a great work recognizing that the immigrants also contribute, you know, to the economy, and they exist. And for example, like a couple of years ago, one of my favorite events they have done is that they gave a diploma to the construction workers, because it's art where they actually do in Aspen. You know, the demand of very high quality services in construction is really art. So
absolutely.
They came with their families and they have this diploma, and it was a very, very beautiful event. They were explaining what they do with the, depending on the construction expertise they have, and it was very beautiful. And now, since you know, the immigrant community is always like, because of the circumstances, is very in the shadows and hidden. It's beautiful that now they are like, they can be shown and say, we are here and we exist too.
I love that. It's definitely a part of the community we don't talk about when we talk about development and stuff like that.
Kudos to the Aspen Art Museum and to the old organizations and that have been supporting this.
That's this Sunday.
This Sunday, that event. 3 p.m.
Lovely.
There will be mariachi and tacos, so we have to go. Everything will be free. So,
Jason, coming up in April, so further off on the horizon, the students of the Aspen School District have said that they are going to join in on that day of action and stand up. They're going to go march at the Pickens County Courthouse and talk about gun control.
Yeah, I think they're going to march from the school
to
Courthouse, County Courthouse. Yeah, I was just kind of trying to get some indication from Dr. Malloy, the superintendent, and I tried to talk to Theron, who was out of town that day, the principal there, but just kind of, you know, how they're reacting to the Florida shooting, and I knew that both the police chief and the sheriff had been up there talking to them after that happened. So and I thought, you know, what are the students gonna be in sort of solidarity with this march for, I can't remember what it's called. It's happening in March,
okay.
In a couple of weeks in D.C. for the Florida. But I ended up talking to this senior who is organizing this march here, and it's going to be in April. And the actual day, of course, escapes me right now.
April 20th, 4/20, obviously.
Oh, 4/20, that's the Columbine.
Exactly.
Right, the anniversary. So, and it sounds great. You know, they've definitely taken the bull by the horns, like the kids in Florida, and really are saying, you know, enough is enough about guns and their safety being threatened and them feeling like nobody's doing anything about it. So I think this is their way to do it. And they're inviting the community. They're inviting the school administrators and staff and everybody to go.
There was a op-ed or a column in the Daily News for Moms for Gun Safety, an event that's happening this evening in Carbondale. It does seem like it's a lot of grassroots, but also the law enforcement is being involved as well. Are they going to up kind of the safety around the schools?
Joe Sheriff DeSalvo said that they're probably – that's his jurisdiction out there, though there are – certainly the city does its share out there too, but they were going to increase patrols kind of immediately to make sure everybody felt safe, but and I think that they're going to do some things in the future to try and plug any holes that might be there. But you know, one of the issues with that camp is that it's an open campus. So if you really want to lock it down, you make it a closed campus.
Right.
And I think Joe DeSalvo has said that this historically this community is not into that. So you can do so much, basically, I think.
Thank you so much, Jason Ossender, who's a reporter with the Aspen Times. Also joining me today are Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News, and Samuel Brunella of Radio La Tricolor. Valley Roundup is a production of Aspen Public Radio News. Thanks for listening. Thank you all.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.